Coming to you from the Deep South, this is the Blue Collar Leadership Podcast. High impact leadership is not reserved for leaders, and it has nothing to do with your position, title, or rank. However, it does have everything to do with your character. It's time to climb to the next level and beyond, personally and professionally. Now, let's start making it happen with your host, Max Story.
Hello, and thanks for listening to the Blue Collar Leadership Podcast today. So today I've got another episode in the Real People Getting Real Results series. And if you've been listening to that, you know everybody that I have on this is somebody that I know somehow. They either met me through my books or my content or the YouTube channel, or I know them personally. And the guest today, I know him personally, been knowing him since 2016. Very special guest. Introduce him to you in just a second, but I want to make sure you know, if you're listening on the Blue Collar Leadership Podcast to the audio, be sure to go check out the Blue Collar Leadership YouTube channel at youtube.com/@Blue Collar Leadership and check out the playlist for the Real People Getting Real Results series. And if you're watching the video, another reason to watch the video is Rhea puts a lot of links, a lot of contact information for the guest and what they're doing. So got that out of the way. Today's guest is Bren Briggs. Welcome to the Blue Collar Leadership Podcast, Bren. Thanks for being a guest today.
Thanks, Mac. I appreciate you having me. It's I think it's going to be a fun time doing this.
Absolutely, it is. You mean a lot to me, man. Since I met you, and before we get into it, I got to say I like that shirt. I know Rhea Story likes that shirt you got on. Resilient.
It means a lot to me, and you know we'll dig into what the meaning behind the shirt is, but. I wear this all the time. It's part of what we do. It's an important message to put out there.
Yeah, we'll dive into that. That'd probably take up a lot of our time today talking about. There's a lot to talk about being resilient. You're a very resilient person, and then you're helping other people be resilient. So we'll get into that without a doubt. Right now, I just want to always open up these episodes and sharing how do we know each other? You remember how we come to know each other?
You know, I was thinking about that when we kind of talked a little bit yesterday, and the initial recollection I had is maybe a little bit different than yours, but with 4 brain injuries, my memory may not be as good as yours. So help me fill in the gaps. But I remember it was either a connection through LinkedIn. I saw you were connected to someone who I followed and really admire. And I thought, man, if he knows that guy, he's got to be somebody. And of course, that was you. So what I remember reaching out and just saying, hey, you know, I'm a big fan of what you're doing or something like that. And normally it's days or weeks if people ever reply to, you know, stuff like that. It was minutes and I got a reply back from you. So the first thought was, this is an AI or, you know, it can't be real. So I wrote something that was probably not like, you know, something AI could respond to. And you responded right back. And it's been a great relationship ever since.
Wow, that's awesome. I really don't remember it like that. I interact with so many people through LinkedIn and been doing it for years and years. I mean, every week is multiple people. So I apologize. You probably are the one remembering it right. All mine run together, especially after that many years. That's eight years ago now.
Yeah.
And pretty quick after we started talking, we went and had to a coffee shop. Met for a little while.
You know, that's something too. I because of the way my mind works, I remember setting up, we had like an hour blocked off. And I thought, you know, I can talk for an hour to almost anybody. And sometimes after 15 minutes, you run out of things to say. I think 3.5 hours later, we were still sitting there and could have gone for another 3 hours. But it was just a great instant connection. And like you said, it's been great ever since.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. And I know when we spoke that day, maybe even before we spoke, we might have been on the phone or messaging. I can't remember, but I know we had a connection because of the 7 habits. You were a fan of the 7 habits, and the 7 habits was the first thing I was ever introduced to relative to personal growth and leadership. Changed my life. How did you know about the 7 habits? Or
so I was when I spent 28 years in the military. The last 20 years of that, or, you know, the second half of my career, whatever, I spent as an Army officer. The first 8 years, we have a little similarity that we were both in the Marine Corps. So I went from enlisted Marine Corps to an Army officer. I want to say as early as my time in the Marine Corps, I had some phenomenal leaders, and they were always pushing leadership development, how to be better and improve yourself. And they would say, you know, they would ask questions like, what do you want to do next year, 5 years, 10 years down the road? And they would develop all of us based on what we wanted to do then, not what we were doing right now that fit their personal mission or, you know, whatever we're doing. So I think as early back as my time in the Corps, but definitely as an Army officer, I was the Army's Lean Six Sigma senior master black belt.
That's right. We had another connection with Lean too.
Talked about that too. And I think that was one of those huge things that kind of drew us together, because we have that connection and similarity. But I ran that program for the Army for the last year, I think 2 years of my career. And all the stuff that we talk about, the seven habits and the lean principles, you know, kind of developed and helped me later become really where I am now. During that really dark time in my life, I was able to lean on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome that it does help you. I mean, I had, you know, somebody, Rene Durone, he's been a guest on the Real People Getting Real Results. And I don't know if you've listened to him. He actually, you probably would like to listen to it. I hadn't even thought about sharing it with you, but he was in a Marine Reserve unit, and then he actually got basically kicked out, but he was suicidal and ooh, having some problems. And he shared that story. So there might be some people that, you know, and we'll talk about what you do here in a minute, and people understand why, but there may be some people, you know, that might get some value out of just listening to his episode on the YouTube channel.
Absolutely. I'll look it up, or if there's a link, you know, I can get, I'll be happy to share it, because that's really what it's all about. And that's what I love about what you're doing with this particular show and just the, you know, the character of who you are, connecting with other people, helping other people, putting stuff out there. It does nothing for you other than knowing that you're helping other people. So that's I just love what you're doing.
Yep. And that young man has reloaded. I mean, he shares a story about being out in his car drinking, had the gun loaded, hammer back, you know, ready to, you know, take his life. And I mean, I got chills now telling you about it, but hearing him tell it on there and seeing who he is now, and he just got a cool story. So I'll share that with you after we're done, and you can figure out, you know, the value that may be in there for someone else that you're talking
definitely
about. Let me just ask you real quick. So 8 years in the Marine Corps, did you go into Marines right out of high school, you know, as a young man?
I did. So the only thing I ever wanted to do, I mean, the earliest memory of what I wanted to do was be a Marine. You know, a lot of the other kids want to be astronauts or policemen or firemen, and it changes throughout their life. My earliest memory was being a Marine. My dad was a Marine. His sister was a Marine. Lots of people in my family served in the military, but all I wanted to do was be in the Marine Corps. So in my junior year, when you could, I don't know if they still do it, but back then we had delayed entry.
Way back in the 1900s, in the old days.
Yeah. So my junior year, as soon as I was eligible, I signed the paper so I could be a Marine. So all year, my senior year, I knew what I was going to do. We had friends, and it may be similar to you, that they weren't sure what college you were going to go to, or were they going to get a scholarship, or what were they going to do. I didn't have that stress. I knew from day one, I was going to be a devil dog.
And what'd you do right out of the gate? What type of jobs, MOS, you know, for us, a lot of people don't know about MOS.
3 weeks out of high school. So while everybody else was enjoying their summer, and the hottest part, I didn't really think about that at 18 years old, hottest part of the summer, I'm in South Carolina, Parris Island, South Carolina. Went through boot camp. I graduated. I don't know if I can say this. I hate bragging about this part, but I was honor grad out of boot camp. You know, usually the people say that they do 4 years and that's all they can ever talk about. So I did have a little bit more than just that. But I was an 0311. I went from infant. I had a. I could have done anything, but I just wanted to be, you know, that textbook Marine. So I had a contract to be in the infantry. And I tell folks, you know, you'll probably get this and understand this. I tell people that I had a hardship tour right out of the gate. You know, it was a hardship tour. They sent me to Hawaii as a 19-year-old single guy.
You poor, pitiful thing, you.
Right. Right. So it was a tough life, but someone had to do it.
Love it. No wonder you stayed in the military so long. They started you out, right?
Exactly. So, and I, so other than the phenomenal duty station, I really had some of the best leaders that I've ever had in my life. My company commander, and I hope I can say was his name. Then it was Captain Barnes. It was First Sergeant Ruedel. And they truly were focused on developing people. And I think because their focus on people, it made everything else. You know, we got all kinds of awards because of Captain Barnes and how he you know, developed us, and our unit just was fantastic because of it.
That's phenomenal. So what rank were you when you got out of the Marine Corps?
I got out of the Marines as an E5, a sergeant. But I didn't get out because I wanted to. It was one of those things that, so the last half of my career, I went from just being a Marine or being in the infantry to a career planner. So it's like it's a recruiter for people who were already in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
I would, again, laugh and joke with people that recruiters have an easy job because they can lie to high school kids and the kids don't know any better. They think what they're saying is a lie. A career planner can't lie to them because they've already been lied to once and they've already served 4 years and they know what reality and the truth is. But my job was to keep good Marines in and let the other ones, you know, transition out to the civilian life and do something different. But in the mid 90s, there was a force reduction. They cut the Marine Corps in half. They cut the other branches significantly, but the Marine Corps got cut in half. And it didn't matter how good you were. And in my case, I had the top NC or fitness reports. So my paperwork, my ratings were as good as they could get, but they just arbitrarily cut the Marine Corps in half. And I was part of the half that got cut out.
Ah, okay.
I tried everything to stay in. So when I got out, it was a bitter experience. I didn't prepare me like I prepared everybody else because I was sure I could save my job, and I couldn't. Yeah. So all the time I spent fighting to stay in retrospect, I could have used it like I helped everybody else. Help them to transition, find a job, you know, look where to go, maybe go to school or whatever. But I was fighting to stay in the Marine Corps. And it was a bitter experience. So I spent probably 11 months just angry and bitter and mad because all I knew was I only wanted to be in the Marine Corps and I didn't know anything else. So that was a tough year. Then an Army recruiter called and, I remember him calling and saying, "Hey, this is Sergeant so-and-so with the Army." Click. And, but thank God he was persistent. He called back and I think the third or fourth time he said his name again. And as I was going, I was hanging the phone up. He said, "Don't hang up on me." So I put the phone back to my ear. He said, "This is, you know, Sergeant so-and-so. I'm with the Army and, you know, with your education and, experience, I can get you a direct commission." I'm like, "What's a direct commission?" So now he had my interest. So, you know, he explained the process of what a direct commission was. And I, again, still bitter, still kind of tainted from the military and the way that they downsized. I said, "Look, if you do it all, then okay. But if you expect me to like wait a year, wait 2 years, you know, because I've seen them that shell game. You probably have seen that and played that shell game too, where they tell you one thing and then something else happens." So he said, "Nope." He said that there's no shell game. There's no game here. He said, I'll do it. If you just tell me you're interested, I'll take care of it. So, okay. And within a couple months, I went from having three stripes, you know, as a Marine to a gold butter bar in the Army.
A whole new journey.
Completely new journey. So I went from, and if you can imagine this, Marine infantry, and in the 80s, there was a lot of stuff going on. So it's not like we just kind of twiddled our thumbs and played around. There were things that we were responding to and involved in, like, I don't think you're old enough to remember. Maybe you do. When we, in 86, we bombed Gaddafi. We bombed Libya.
Yeah, I remember. I graduated high school 87. So I wasn't far behind you.
Okay.
I remember that.
So we were the unit. The very next day, we were sent down there to, you know, act as a responding force or a blocking force in case we totally expected them to act up and do something. But Gaddafi was quiet after that. So, you know, but we were sent down there. So we did a lot of that kind of stuff. So I went from that life to an Army medical officer. Completely different lifestyle.
Yeah.
When I went to basic OBC, officer basic training, there were literally majors and captains standing there with their hat, you know, kind of sitting on the back of their head. They had their hands in their pockets. And these are doctors. They're not like soldiers and Marines or Army guys. They're doctors who were in uniform. So it took me a minute to kind of adjust and say, you know, it's not my job to correct them and how to teach them to wear the uniform and to march and do all that other stuff. So going from, you know, Marine Corps infantry to the medical world was a bit of a change.
So yeah, that's a big change shifting into the, from infantry to working in the medical group in the Army. Besides, you're not a Marine. Maybe that was a ploy to cut the Marine Corps in half and let a lot of Marines go infiltrate the other division.
You know, it did happen though. So I wasn't the only one. We did see a lot of Marines in, you know, throughout my probably the first 8 to 10 years. And then sometimes later on too, a lot of Marines were, you know, and ended up in the Army.
Yeah. So that's awesome. So I don't want to go to this part real quick, but I do want to share with people in case so they know what's coming. But real quick, just jump into what are you doing right now? But we're going to jump back in a minute. But I don't want people to have to wait so long to find out what you're doing now.
What
but we'll get back to why you're doing it in a minute. But what are you doing right now today?
So the last 8 years, I've been running a nonprofit focused on veterans and helping veterans and their families. You know, a lot of groups don't focus on the family. They look at just the vet. But we work with veterans and their families and really everything that they need. So if they need a job, we help them find jobs. They need food, clothing, housing, shelter. We can help with all that stuff. But the one thing that we do that's probably the most important, and you identified it earlier, is this right here. You know, getting out for a lot of guys is a tough transition, and they don't understand the power that's inside of them. And we help them realize who they're, you know, what their identity is, and what their purpose is.
That's outstanding. So what's the name of your organization?
The Eden, like the Garden of Eden, the Eden Project.
Yeah, that's, and I know, but everybody listening doesn't know, but where are you located and why you picked that name?
Wow. So we're located in Fayetteville, Georgia. So it's just south of Atlanta, Georgia. Lot of really cool stuff going on here. And it's not, you know, this wasn't my choice location, but I've got kids who are in school and they're in some phenomenal schools. So staying here to let them finish school is why we're here. My last duty station was here anyway. So it kind of made sense that I was here already, kind of had a good base and the kids were in school. So that's why we're here. And the name is kind of comes from two different sources.
Yeah.
The basic thing that I used to tell people really for, you know, to just see where they were was if we get back to the way God intended things to be, back to the Garden of Eden, all these problems go away.
100%.
It's because we're not living like that we, you know, we have all these problems. So that was the basis of the name. And we've tossed around a ton of names. you were around in the very beginning when we went through some of this stuff. But the other reason, and it's just as important, probably more important, is my daughter's name is Eden. Of course, she was named after the Garden of Eden, but beautiful name, beautiful young lady. But one thing that we can dig into this now, later, whenever you want to. I was in a bad accident on my last deployment to Iraq.
Yeah, go ahead and go into that, because, you know, sharing your story, like Rhea, people that know Rhea, she's got an unbelievable, horrific story of what she experienced in life. But when people know your story, the story you're about to tell, it gives meaning to you and what you're doing as an organization. And people see you, everything is on a foundation. That's why it's so important. I know a lot of folks like you don't like to share that story from a place of humility, but it gives everything else you do a different level of engagement, buy-in. So share, get to that story. That's a powerful story.
Honestly, it's because of you, Mac, and another good friend of ours, Kathy, that really has encouraged and pushed to talk about that. I just want to work and serve people and get to the serving part. And you have encouraged me to say, slow down a little bit. You have to prep, in my world, you have to prep the battlefield, let people know why you're where you are, and give them the reason of, you know, where things are. So
begin with the end in mind. That's my language, right? Prep the battlefield. Either way, it's the same thing as having 2 out of 7 habits.
So last deployment to Iraq, I'd been in probably maybe 15, 16 years at this point. We had at the time, soft-sided Humvees. You know, these are the Humvees that had just canvas tops.
Early on, before they were really protected.
That's exactly right. So
they were not protected at all.
A slingshot could go through, you know, a good slingshot with the right rock, you know, literally could get through that canvas.
Yep.
So early 2005, 2006, our unit went from the soft-sided Humvee to the up-armored Humvee. If anyone is familiar with those vehicles, they know that they drive completely different. They're really top-heavy and they're armored, so they handle completely different.
Yeah, they were not designed to carry that load that high up.
That's right. And when you're driving on uneven terrain and sand and different things, then it just adds to that instability. Well, as we were leaving, first time in the up armored Humvee, we rolled over. I know, that's what I said to him, like, come on. And I'm the Humvee's upside down, and I felt, have you ever been stung by a bee?
Yeah.
I felt like I was being stung by like 1,000 bees all at the same time. It was just this burning hot feeling on the side of my face. And not knowing at the time, but my jaw was broken. But you know, I didn't know that. So I reached up and just kind of jerked my jaw and it went back in place. But the body is pretty amazing. The muscles tightened up around the jaw and it held the jaw at that, you know, in place. I crawled out of the Humvee and everybody else was okay. So it was, you know, not that big of a deal. It didn't feel like it, didn't look like it at the time. Everybody else is okay. So we just carried on. But I was in a ton of pain. So later that day, the pain just got worse and worse and worse. I skipped dinner, which I don't know if you can see me. I don't skip too many meals.
I'm doing all right, Brian. I saw you yesterday.
But that night, I had to skip dinner. So I took a shower, went to bed. Middle of the night, I woke up. The muscles at this point had relaxed. And now my jaw was, the bone had overlapped and it was stuck like, you know, like that, just locked open. I remember waking up the warrant officer that was in the room with me. And, I'm like, hey man, I got to get to the aid station. Typical warrant officer fashion. He's like, dude, you look crazy. I need to get a picture of this. So instead of getting to the hospital, instead of taking care of you, it's like, hey, let's get a picture of how crazy you look. Get over to the hospital.
Have that picture?
He probably does, but okay. I don't know that I ever even saw it, you know, because my mind at that point, my mind was on, you know, focused on.
Oh, no doubt. I was just curious if you ever got it anyway.
It'd be really cool to have that. That'd be kind of a neat thing to share, to add to this. But I get to the hospital, and remember I said I was a medical officer. Well, I didn't go to Iraq as a medical officer. I went over as an acquisitions officer, you know, doing a lot of different things. Get to the hospital, and who's running the aid station but somebody that I had gone to my officer basic course with.
Okay.
So I get there, and she took one look at me. She's like, oh, my God, you have got to get out here. And she had me on a 36-hour rotation, send me to a launch stool. And I said, no. I'm too important. I've got to stay. I've got all these things to do, and this is what I've got going on. And, you know.
What rank were you then?
I was a captain, but I was an important captain.
Yeah.
So she said no, I said yes, and we went back and forth. And finally, I say I won, but truly I lost because she let me stay, gave me a big bag of drugs, you know, typical military VA type answer to something, gave me the drugs, went back to my unit, and maybe 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, I couldn't handle the pain. Went back to her and she said, yeah, I told you so. So instead of going to launch stool, though, she sent me back to Atlanta because Eisenhower Hospital in Augusta specializes in facial trauma. What we found out that obviously the jaw was broken, but my right eye socket was smashed. Wow. My nose was smashed. My throat was smashed. Both of my cheekbones had to be replaced. So both of my cheekbones are implants.
Wow.
My jaw was so damaged, they had to cut both of the jaws out, rebuild them on a table, and then put them back in my face and wire them in and put brackets and screws.
Wow. You had some good doctors, man, because you look good. I know you've always talked about you get a little self-conscious, but nobody would ever know any of that.
I appreciate you saying that. And all Army doctors, I give credit to Army doctors who did all this work. One of the last surgeries that they did, my chin is also fake and is an implant. So they were asking, and one of the reasons I wear the goatee is because of this. I've got
you look good with that too, Brian. You just got the whole package, man.
You're
resilient.
That's right. That's right. I've got what they call, what I call a butt chin. There's a little dimple in the chin.
Oh, okay. I never noticed. Yep.
And when the doctor said, you know, what are you looking for? What do you want to do? What do you want to keep or not keep? I said, I like that. I said, can you make sure I keep that? So he said, okay. But they put the implant on crooked. So you wouldn't notice, probably nobody else would ever notice it. But when I look, I see the crooked chin. So yeah. I wear the goatee to kind of hide the chin. But for the first probably 10 years, it's gotten a little bit better recently. But for the first 10 years, I couldn't feel my face from here down. I taught for the Army. And you probably know this too. The first class after lunch is always like the worst class to teach.
Yeah.
So typically, you know, you're like this. The students in the class are, you know, like struggling to stay awake because of lunch or whatever else. But they were locked in. They were focused on me. And I thought, man, I am really killing this class. It was a Lean Six Sigma course.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, man, I'm really, really nailing this and feeling pretty good about myself. First break about 2 o'clock, the first break rolls up and this one staff sergeant said, hey, sir. I'm like, yeah, man. Cause I'm thinking he's going to ask a question about, you know, what I was teaching. He said, you've got some food on your face. I said, what? He goes, you got a little bit of food on your, like a piece of the sandwich or whatever was stuck right here. I can't feel my face.
You couldn't feel like, normally you feel a little something not right.
Exactly. But since I can't feel from here down, I didn't know it was there. The entire class was making bets on when it would fall off, if it would fall off, or how it would fall off. And I said, do you guys even have a clue what I talked about? They're like, no, but, you know, so-and-so won the bet the food would stay. But that's, you know, kind of the experience. There's some good parts and bad parts, but 6 major surgeries. I spent a week in the intensive care unit when they cut my face out to rebuild it. And probably that in itself is hard. You know, those kind of surgeries when they're doing that stuff, it is difficult. And so I got to work with the doctors. You know, we talked about the Army doctors and, yep. and the fact that they did this good of a job. Up to that point, the procedure that was standard, they would cut from here, you know, from your ear, depending on how much work they needed to do. They would cut here around the hairline and pull the skin down and then do whatever work they needed to do and then stitch it back up.
Wow.
I like to say I'm not a vain person, but I think maybe I am a little vain because I said, I've seen that and I don't really want that for the rest of my life. And the doctor's like, okay. So they waited a couple months and they said, well, here's another surgery we can try. We will cut from here, you know, from instead of doing the whole scalp, they would cut from the side and then kind of do the work that way. I said, have you ever done it? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, I don't think I want to be the first one for that. And it just didn't sound, again, you know, the same type of thing was going to happen. So waited about another month and, they said, okay, here, we've never done this one either. However, they were going to go inside the mouth and kind of, then they cut from here to here inside the mouth and then down here. And they pulled all the face out that way. So wow. when y'all don't see the kind of work, that's why. They were able to go inside the mouth and do all the replacing and fixing that they needed to do from cutting in here. There's stitches from here to here, you know, across there and then down around and moved everything.
But inside. They basically took out all your bone structure or moved it around and replaced it or worked on it from inside of your mouth.
Every bit of it. Yep.
Wow.
I think there's 8 teeth missing to make the jaw and make my throat. Cause when they crushed my throat, I couldn't breathe. So they had to remove the teeth and create more space back there for that to happen.
Wow. I really appreciate you sharing all this, Brian, and not just for me and my audience, but you're going to be able to share it. And a lot of people that you meet or interact with, you know, from now on, you'll be able to say, hey, if you want to hear my story, go check it out. Cause you're able to tell it, you're telling it pretty in depth here. And I want you to do that. I want you to leverage who you are to help all those people that you want to help that you've been through some stuff too. Everybody been through some kind of stuff, but it's all different, but it causes us some problems sometimes.
I appreciate that. You know, it took years to really acknowledge it and say it. And I lived with a lot of shame because it was an accident and everyone thinks, okay, you're injured in Iraq. You were there, you know, during the war, during the surge. And it was a really pain point for me for a long time saying, yeah, but it was an accident. The Humvee rolled over. I wasn't shot at. I wasn't blown up. It wasn't one of those kind of cool stories, if you will, that other people have. Yeah. It was an accident. So I lived with that shame for a long time, but the difficult time, that was the physical trauma. The really hard part is I think you remember a little bit of this from, you know, from when you met me. I spent a week in the intensive care unit and all 6 of those surgeries.
Yep.
My wife at the time didn't go to a single surgery. And wow. The entire week that I spent the intensive care, never heard from her once.
Well, that's hard to hear now. It was hard to hear the first time you shared it, and it's probably still hard for you to tell it.
It is. So I take a deep breath and I, you know, I practice some of the tools that we teach. Even this many years after that event, the emotional pain and trauma was harder than the physical pain and trauma. I remember laying in the intensive care unit and I've got wires strapped everywhere. You know, my face has just been replaced and I've got, you know, the cone of shame that they put on dogs.
Mm.
I had a cone of shame on because they don't want you touching your face. So I've got this big cone on my face and I've got that with all these wires connected to me and the stitching and my face is huge. So they give you a morphine pump. It's a little thing. So if you're feeling pain, you can push the pump and get it. I don't remember physical pain, but I remember pushing the pump because the loneliness was hard.
Yeah.
So it was out of that experience, you know, and I'll skip ahead a little bit. We'll jump around a little bit maybe. It was truly out of that experience and being alone and not having the family there, not having the support, that really that's where the Eden Project came from.
From that pain.
Yep.
You know, there's other people suffering all kinds of pain, mental pain more probably than physical. I mean, you probably help people struggling more with mental pain, if you want to use that word.
Years after that, I started teaching for, you know, once I was retired and out of the Army and trying to figure out, you know, who the new me is and what am I going to do now? I started teaching another veteran program for a different organization. And I had never told my story. And I still don't really tell it in a lot of detail. This was probably the most detail that I've shared in a while.
I appreciate it.
But I shared with them about the accident and the shame. And so this particular group, I think there was 16 or 18 couples. It was a weekend couples retreat. Yep. And directly in front of me was a Marine. And of course, you know, I knew everybody, you know, who they were, and I knew, you know, what they were. So and up to that point, I'm like, yeah, you know, we're partners, we're brothers, we're brothers in arms. So, but as I told my story, he got more and more agitated. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's not a wall between us. There's not a stage between us. He looks like he's getting upset. But I finished and you know, said what I needed to say. We took a break and him and his wife came during the break. And his wife said this, and this is one of the only reasons that I continue to tell my story. She said that was his story.
Wow.
He was injured in an accident, nothing combat related, none of that, you know, cool stuff that you always hear. And he lived with the same kind of shame, which is why they were in the program.
That's pretty powerful, though. Yeah. That's powerful for you. Don't worry about those emotions, man. Those emotions are strong. That's not a weakness when you display those emotions. I always tell people, a lot of times you'll see somebody, you know, sometimes I get shook up when I'm speaking, talking about, you know, my bad relationship with Eric, when I'm talking about those bad years.
Yeah.
And always after I get emotional, I use it as a teaching lesson to tell people, you know, how many of you saw me as weak in that moment, or how many saw me as strong in that moment, that I'm being vulnerable and sharing from a place of authenticity about my bad leadership of myself and parenting with my son. And there's a certain thing I talk about where I do get emotional like that. Nobody, you know, when Rhea's sharing her story, nobody sees her as weak. They see her as strong. So embrace those good emotions. That just means it's real. That means you care. That's good stuff.
When I do, and I appreciate that, Matt, because that's, you know, when we do our peer groups, I say that, but I'm thinking in my peer group, it's my group. I'm trying to represent on your show and be a good guest on your show. And like, man, no one wants to see that on his show.
You're also, it's real. That's why it's called real people getting real results. I mean, you're a real person, and I want you to finish that story, but I want to, why I've got it interrupted sharing that little lesson right there. I want to share, Rhea and I was speaking for a company, actually it was Bluebird Bus. We were speaking to all 110 of their leaders. We did a 4-hour session on blue collar leadership and culture, 5 components for building high performance teams. And we had been there for like 2 weeks, but this is just like a middle of the 2-week slot that we did a 4-hour talk on the big picture of culture instead of leadership development. And there was a guy come up at the end, and a lot of people were talking to us. We were in like an auditorium at a school, and I already knew him from what we've been doing with him for the previous 3 or 4 days. And so I knew him and everything, but he come up and he stood off to the side and he waited and waited for everybody to leave. And then he walked up and he's in his 60s, I think, this guy, and his forehead was down and he's looking serious. And I already knew he had been in Marines, and he was a sniper in the Marine Corps at some point, you know, early back in his life. And he's looking all serious like you're talking about. And he waited for everybody to go. And then he walked up and He just staring at me and his chin started quivering. And finally he was able to talk. He said, you just changed my life. He said what the guy said to you. He told me, he said, your story is my story.
Ah.
He said, who you used to be, I still am. and I want to be better. And, you know, It's just a little thing, but later on after that, it was a dent around Easter weekend last year. And he caught me one day. He said, I just want to tell you, man, we over the holidays, we went up and saw some family in Tennessee from Georgia. And he said, I just want you to know I wore my seatbelt. You know, that's a little thing, but it ain't a little thing because he never wore a seatbelt.
Ah.
I said, you don't ever wear your seatbelt? He said, nah, man, I ain't worried about a seatbelt. I said, why you wear it this time? He said, because I'm trying to be better. My wife always wants me to wear my seatbelt. So I put my seatbelt on for her. I mean, that's what telling our story will do. So get back to your story. I want to just share that. It was so closely related to the same moment. So that guy, your story was his story.
That's powerful. So like you, that's why I continue to share that. It's not comfortable. I don't enjoy it. It's not one of those things that I'm proud about. Like, I don't know, like, you know, writing 34 books, that's something to be proud of. But this particular, you know, time in my life, it was not something to be proud of. But I know that, like with you, it has such an impact on somebody listening that I'll go ahead and put myself in that uncomfortable spot.
Yep. That's what high impact leaders do. That's part of the sacrifice of being a leader. Cause we talk about leadership is influence. And what we're trying to do is we're not trying to boss anybody by telling our story. We're trying to motivate and inspire, influence people to live a better life, make some different choices, to be resilient. Like your shirt said, that's the perfect shirt. I know you wore it on purpose.
Yeah.
That's a good move right there, Brent, wearing that shirt about being resilient.
So we give these shirts to the people in our peer groups. Our peer groups are 13 weeks long. There's a lot of organizations out there that provide services to veterans. And I, some of them I've gone through and literally are life-changing. But imagine taking a semester's worth of college and cramming it into a week. And then taking people who are already vulnerable and damaged, and in my case and many others, have brain injuries, and cramming a semester's worth of college into that week, and then send them home. Well, that's not a great model. It's got its good points, and you can bring people from around the world, around the country, to one location and give it to them. But the end of that week, they have to go home and try and remember all that stuff. Our program is 13 weeks. We take a little bit of information and each week kind of build on the previous week, but we take a little bit and put it in there. And by the end of it, you know, I think week 8 or so, we talk specifically about resiliency and being resilient and the fact that they already are resilient. They just need to understand it and embrace it, if you will, for lack of a better term. But yes, this is it's a big part of our program. And I'm learning. It's funny. I'll tell other people that they're resilient. I'll tell other people that how strong and powerful they are. But when it comes to yourself, it's like, yeah, I'm really not that. But hearing it from you, I appreciate it.
You absolutely are. You're a great model of that. And you know, it's phenomenal. You do have the courage to share your story. I remember when I first saw you share it over there at I can't even remember the name of it now, on that stage where they had
Pinewood.
Pinewood Studios. When they, I don't know if they still do that or not, but I went over and I remember you weren't excited to get up there and share your story. I remember, I think we recorded it. One of us recorded it and sent you a little iPhone video of it back those days, but it's been powerful. And because you're sharing your story, you give others the freedom and the courage and the inspiration to share their story, because Les Brown says it best. He said, everybody's got a story to tell. And there's people out there that they won't be helped unless they hear your story, not my story, not Rio's story, not somebody else's story. Like the guy who come up to me, he said, your story is my story. There may be no other story he could have heard that would have helped him. Yep. Same way with the guy for you. We don't ever know who that is. So we have to buckle down, put our seatbelt on and tell our story, because it ain't about us. But I always tell people, leadership, it ain't about me, but it starts with me. Yeah. Right? It starts with me having the courage to model this stuff that I talk about. And that's what you're doing. You're modeling it. You went through a lot of that stuff. You live the seven habits. I mean,
not knowing it. And that's the funny thing is, you know, so I learned it early on, and it was probably in the, like you or maybe many others, it was in the back of my mind, but living it. And I realized after I looked this up again, just to make sure, I'm like, okay, if this comes up, I mean, holy cow, that's it. That's what we've been doing. Some of it is intentional. Some of it is just part of who we are and who we've become.
Yeah. So another part of our story together, our journey is we published that book together. Yep. Phoenix. Do you happen to have a copy of that laying close to you? I don't have one by me, but I didn't know if you had one with you.
You know, I had it, and I cleaned my desk. So I wanted to make sure everything looked good. I wasn't sure what you were going to see, and I just took it off. I can go get it. It's across the office, but
it's okay. Rhea's in the background back there. She might be able to find a copy of the cover copy and just pop it up in a minute while we're talking about it. If so, that'll be cool. She can interrupt us and show that if she can do it. I don't know if she can, but it's a cool cover. But you and I come up with the design, the layout of that book and everything. You want to talk about how we even got to that point? How did that happen?
I was going to say, do you want me to talk about that part or do you want to cover that? Because I mean, that really is I think in everybody's life, there's these major turning points. And that truly was one of those major turning points in my life because.
Yeah. I'd like you to share about it. People don't know, but you got a podcast. And yep. Rhea pop that link up there, the information, the after action report. That's I was on awesome. There yesterday with you, which led us to this, right? And so I was like, man, you need to be on here. And Michael said, you need to get on the podcast. So people who make things happen, make it happen. So within 24 hours, here we are doing this one. But
well, one of the things that you made happen, you know, I was kicking around the idea, and I'm not even sure how far along the process we were for developing the Eden Project.
There it is.
That is fantastic.
Leave that up for a minute, Rhea, while he's talking, because he's going to talk about that cover.
And we'll talk specific details about that, because there's some Easter eggs that we hid in there, that people can look for or find later. But there's a part of my story that I really don't ever talk about, because it's just... again, you know, some parts are dark and hard and a struggle. But during the time where you saw me speak, and it was probably right after that.
And we'll get rid of this image till you start talking about those Easter eggs in a minute. So we'll go back to the regular layout while you're telling this story.
Okay. I was homeless. So going through this horrible, nasty divorce, from the wife who didn't, you know, visit me in the hospital and wasn't with me during that time. So we were going through this really horrible, ugly divorce. So we were ordered to sell the house and get rid of, you know, things. And the house sold faster than I could find some place to stay.
Yeah.
So I spent, I think, 6 or 8 weeks living, or, you know, couch surfing. Trying to figure it out. And during that time, it was during the summer. The arrangement was the kids would be with me for a week and be with their mom for a week. Well, I certainly wasn't going to tell her that I'm homeless, because you know what that answer would have been. I just wouldn't have got to see the kids at all.
Yeah.
And I to this day, I don't remember exactly how it happened, but I remember what happened.
Yeah. I think you were just sharing that you were bouncing around or in between. One day we talked and you were just telling me part of what you just shared, I think.
And these two angels appeared in my life. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on the screen with one of them, but the fact that you and Rhea opened up your door to someone who you didn't even really know.
Not really.
And that's where I would stay with you guys for a week. And then in the weeks the days in between, I had a park that I stayed at, and I had, my car obviously in a church, you know, so I would go someplace, and I think I came back with you guys for a little bit again after that. But the fact that you opened up your house to me and my kids at that time, when, you know, almost strangers, just speaks volumes to who you are and your character and you and Rhea.
And then we left you, because I remember we had to go out to Austin. We were gone for A lot of the times we were not.
That's right. That's right. And you even left the house. I mean, it again, it speaks volumes of who you and Rhea are. But one night, like 2:30 in the morning, we're both night owls. Yep. We're up talking about the concept of what I wanted to do. And I remember thinking that I had this really grandiose plan for the peer program. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew we were going to do peer groups, and I knew that I wanted to break it up over time, not do it all in one week. But it was really, I remember it was really heavy medical, heavy psychology type stuff. And I remember saying, I want to do this. And you're like, yeah, I got that. I'm like, yeah, but I want to do this. And then from there, I want to go here. And you're like, yeah, I got that too. Yeah, but I want to, and I just remember kind of in my mind, you know, we were going back and forth, and finally, it took me a minute, but I finally stopped and said, okay, so what do you got? And then I stopped talking and I started listening, and you shared with me the concept. I don't know if you already had the book written or the concept.
I had wrote about the 10 foundational elements of intentional transformation. I had wrote a small piece of that in my book, 10 Values of High Impact Leaders. I knew one day I was going to turn that into a complete book. So I just realized in that moment that, hey, I can make this fit and help Brian on his mission. And basically, anybody knows my books are 30 chapters, 3 pages each. So that one's 10 sections, 3 chapters each. And so the Phoenix, I knew the first two chapters of the book I was going to write was going to be teaching. And the third chapter was going to be my personal story related to those first two chapters. And then what I knew real quick was we could turn that into something for you. And we come up with that idea of the Phoenix and the design of it. And I'll let you share about that in a minute, what all that means and why it's like that, why it's got the little, the superscript 3 there and the other stuff. But so what I knew was I'd keep the first two chapters of each section the same. And then we talked and you come up and did some research and found some military stories that kind of related to what I was teaching. And so that's what I wrote, the first two chapters of each section, and you supplied the story, and then we created that book.
And that was the foundation for the program we used for the first 4 or 5 years of our peer groups. I knew going into this, you know, in the development stage, that guys and girls coming out of the military, there was usually two things that they struggled with, either one or the other, or generally both. There was a loss of identity, and they didn't have a purpose. So trying to figure out who they were going to be or what they were, you know, they were no longer that Marine, that infantry guy, that supply person or whatever. They had to come up with their new identity and transform into whatever they were going to be post-military. So that's where we were headed. And I knew that's where I wanted to go, but it was so heavy medical and heavy psychology, and it didn't need to be, because you had the answers.
Well, I don't know about that. We came up with it. Habit 6 out of 7 habits, for anybody listening, is synergize. You know, 1 + 1 equals something greater than 2. And that's what we come up with. It wasn't my idea or your idea. It's our idea, that concept. And we end up calling it the Phoenix Force. Nothing against Wounded Warrior. They do a lot of good stuff.
Great stuff. That's right.
That just, I mean, you didn't want to be the Wounded Warrior. You wanted to create the Phoenix Force. You can explain that far better than I can.
Yeah. So, you know, again, not bashing anybody else, but we didn't want to highlight the word wounded or injured, or you have a label of a disability. I hate putting the D on post-traumatic stress. So I don't use the D. I don't like to use wounded. You know, I'm a veteran with injuries, but I'm not that injured veteran. And sometimes wordplay is significant of what goes on up here. So I didn't want to go down that route. And I think you and I were kicking around, you know, we're broken, but we're building up and we're coming out and we're rebuilding, and one concept, you know, led to the other. And we came up with the Phoenix, you know, rising out of the ashes, being burnt, if you will, or dying, if you will, you know, whatever the mythical Phoenix was, but that rising out of the ashes as something bigger, stronger, better than they were before.
Yeah. And that cover, I mean, Rhea helped us out. I think you got somebody to design the Phoenix. We kind of got an idea of what we wanted to look like. Pop that back up, Rhea, if you can, in the background. Let Brian talk about that cover a little bit, but Rhea created, she does a cover for all of our books. And you know, those 34 books, I didn't write all of them. She's a big part of, she's got, you know, half of those books or more are hers. Talk about that, the cover that we came up with. And I really like that thing, man. It just looks good.
It does. So I'll talk about where it was then and the minor tweaks that we've made as we're going through this rebranding right now. Yep. So we did find a phoenix, but it didn't really match exactly what I was looking for. What we did and what's unique about our phoenix is if you look in the wings, the way the feathers are if you look at the right wing specifically, it's in the shape of an E. So there's an E in each of the wings, and then the tail has also got three feathers. That's also represents an E. So each of the wings represent encourage, engage, and empower. That's what we do with our veterans. We get them first. You know, we rearrange the words a little bit, but we first have to engage with them and find them, you know, connect with them and kind of set that foundation so that they're able to listen and take in the knowledge that we have.
Yep.
So once we engage with them, then we empower them. We give them all the tools and skills and things that they need, the 7 habits and you know, a lot of other content behavior type stuff. Yeah, great content. So we empower them with all that, and then we encourage them to use it and then, you know, go out and live their best life. So that's that little 3 above the E is the encourage, engage, and empower. What we've done with the Phoenix recently though is we've flip-flopped it. So instead of the head facing to the left, we have it facing to the right, looking to the future. Okay. And we have it kind of angled up just a little bit. So, you know, it's like more proud looking to the future.
That's awesome.
It's pretty exciting. You can tell
it's going up because it's looking up.
That's right. Yep.
It ain't deciding which way to go. It ain't looking off to the side. I like that. Yep. So is it the same Phoenix, just a different twist on the head shape?
Basically, they took it, and again, I'm not a graphics guy, but they took it and they just flip-flopped it. So now it's looking the right way, and they angled his head up just a little bit more. But
that's awesome.
The feathers are the same, the tail's the same, because I'm not going to let that part change. I mean, that is our Phoenix.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. For anybody listening, I mean, you and I agreed that that book is basically priced as low as I could price it on Amazon. Yeah. There really not hardly any royalty whatsoever comes from it. It's, I think it's $4 or $5 if I remember right, something like that. So anybody who might want to check that out, and my version is out there, different than that book, but it's 10 Foundational Elements of Intentional Transformation, How to Become Your Best Self. But again, 2/3 of those books are identical. It's just that third chapter each time slightly different.
I love ours because you set the base and the foundation and put some great stuff in there. And then we were able to match a story that either it was one of our stories or another veteran who did something really cool that related to that material. So a lot of fun to put together. And I think it's a great read. So it'd be really cool if people would go out and get that, because super easy to read. I tell people that it was written by Marines for Marines.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Yeah. So that's really cool. And I just love, you got that logo, you got the Phoenix, and you got that. That's part of your brand. It's not, yep. I mean, Eden Project is your organization, but a big component of it is that brand. So it's cool to have done that with you. So,
yep.
So what part of your story have you not shared you wanted to share?
So, you know, I think the part we talked about, the dark part, and I think that's where people tend to hang out, to like, oh my gosh, you know, that was horrible. And it was horrible. That was the worst thing that I've gone through. I wouldn't want anyone to go through anything like that. But the good news is you don't have to stay there.
That's right.
If you can, but why? So it was a choice that I, you know, me and everybody else has, because I speak a lot for the veteran community. A lot of vets get there, and typically when they are struggling with that kind of trauma, whether it's combat trauma, emotional trauma, family, you know, trauma, whatever the trauma is, veterans notoriously go to either alcohol or drug abuse or some type of risky behavior. Rarely do we, whether it's a veteran thing or a man thing, do we reach out and ask for help. That's usually the last thing anyone ever does, right? They try the alcohol first. Well, that didn't help. I try the drugs. Well, that didn't help. And they go through all this other stuff. And, you know, none of that helps. I had a choice of doing that or trying to find something that was going to be of benefit. And in my case, there was no services around us that offered what I needed, what my family needed.
Yeah.
So it was either sit here and complain about what we don't have or create it.
Yep.
We created it.
Make it happen.
Make it happen. Yep. You're the one who says, if you don't make it happen, someone else will, or something like that.
Yep. But relative to this, nobody may make it happen the way that you're doing it. Right. I do say that make it happen or someone else will. It might as well be you. But in this case, it's so important, just in case somebody else doesn't make it happen, you better make it happen.
And you're right. No one was doing what we did. So I got with some other guys who were retiring about the time that I did. And a common term on military bases is a one-stop shop. Yeah. So you go to that one place and get your ID card, you get your marriage license, you get, you know, everything you need in that one place. So that's the high level concept of who we are and what we do. We want to be the one-stop shop. Now, we also don't want to spread ourselves so thin that we're trying to do everything. So we have some phenomenal partners that specialize in all these other things. So if someone comes to us and they need help with their VA claim, we can give them some high level tips, but we have a partner that specializes in working with VA claims. So we partner with them. If they're looking to write a resume or find a job, we do a lot of that.
Yeah.
We have partners who specialize in that stuff so that we can focus on what we do that nobody else does. And that's our peer program.
Yeah. That seems like we talked about that maybe that night that we were up, and just so everybody knows, there was no alcohol involved.
Right.
Right. I haven't drank since 2012, but there was no drinking going on. We were just talking, synergizing. We did it for hours, but we come up with a lot in a hurry. Yep. And then you maximize that in a big way.
It's one thing to talk about it, and it's you know, talking cool, because that's the first step, but you got to take action and do something with it. And your encouragement and just having that energy, that support behind me, like you were, we made it happen.
And there's a phone number they can reach out to you there. I want to ask you a couple things that I was thinking about while you were talking. I did good. I didn't interrupt you. Sometimes I interrupt because I won't remember later.
Right, right.
I can't put it on pause and go back to it. But something you just said reminded me of it. But a couple of things. One thing I want to talk about, anything behind you back there, if you want to mention any of that. I see a K-bar down there. People hear me talking about K-bar moments.
Yep.
That's one of them. I try to avoid them now. But the first thing before we talk about that, I want to share with you. You went to boot camp in the summer in Parris Island. And I guess I was being smart, or maybe I was being silly because I was young. I waited till September. I think I went on September 10th. I wanted to play for a while before I went.
Right, right.
I wanted to party and goof off and do all that stupid stuff I was doing as a teenager. But the sand fleas were crazy. I don't know if they're there in the summer or they're just there in the fall.
But I think they're trained.
Yeah, though. People who don't understand what a sand flea is, I tell them it's like a gnat, but it's got teeth like a great white.
That's a great way to put it.
That thing would gnaw you to death. But anyway, we had to stand out of tension out there for like hours, just letting them things eat us. Did they do that to you?
And there's not just one. They bring all their buddies with them. Oh, so if they find a weak spot.
Ears, nose.
Yes, they will find it. And then all their buddies join them. Oh, yeah. They were there then, too.
I remember one inspection we had. Commanding officer or whoever, I don't remember what officer it was, but some officer come. We had to stand there for like an hour waiting on them. Yep. When they come up, you know, I was at attention. I had my elbows, everything. I was tucked in trying to prevent as much space available to those sand fleas.
Yep.
I remember that guy come by me and he's like, he stuck his hand in between my arm and my side. He's like, loosen up, son. You don't have to be so,
right.
So intense. And sir, yes, sir. You know, I'm thinking, there's a reason I'm clamped up. One little piece of me that these things can't bite.
That's smart. I didn't think about that, but that's pretty smart.
It didn't work too good. I mean, ain't a whole lot. Maybe my elbows or my forearms was all that I was helping, but a little bit of that. But what, anything you want to point out behind you back there?
Yep. The flag was a flag I was given on one of my deployments. So, you know, when you deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, that was one of the flags I got. Each of the coins, I could probably speak for an hour on each of the different coins. There's one from the Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense, for a Lean Six Sigma project I did. There's a couple 2-star and 3-star coins for the same reason that when you're good at something, and I'm not trying to brag about this, there's some things that people really, really excel at. Don't ask me to golf because you're not going to get anything good out of that. But I'm good at Lean and the Six Sigma skills and tools. So I've got a lot of awards from that. But the unit pictures are both from the Marine Corps units that I was in. That's what the pictures you see. And the K-bar and the sword were gifts when I left different units in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. Yes. That's a cool looking wall back there. And, you know, I'm better now, but I used to have a short temper, and I used to talk about them K-bar moments, meaning I wanted to take that K-bar and run up somebody's rib cage. Whenever I said K-bar moment, but I'm better now, but that's part of my journey. I would just like to share with the audience real quick. I talked about the 10 foundational elements of intentional transformation. If you'd like to see an excerpt of that book, you can go to bluecollarleadership.com/download. All of my books and Rhea's books are there to be, not all of them, most of them. And you can read an excerpt from those books there, just for anybody listening. If you're looking for personal transformation, leadership development, what's your greatest, if you had to pull, I know it's putting you on the spot, but if you had to pull some leadership nugget, personal growth nugget, quote, thought, what's something that stands out to you from your life that like it's important, if somebody hadn't thought about it, just something to provoke some thought and raise some awareness around taking ownership of self.
So to me, it's actually a lesson I just taught at our peer group. It's how powerful our mind is. People don't realize how powerful their mind is, and a lot of this comes from, and I'm hoping it's something, if I can work with Rhea and her schedule, have her on our podcast about victimhood, is we control our thoughts control our actions, and our actions, you know, we talked about that yesterday, control our destiny. What people don't understand is they do have power over their thoughts. And if they understand that, then that means they have responsibility for their actions and everything that happens afterwards. But that's typically where people give me pushback and say, no, this happened to me, therefore I am, you know, whatever. And you can fill in the blank with whatever that is. But I want to tell them is, I'm sorry that happened. You know, that's horrible. You know, whatever it was, it's tragic. However, it's your response to that that's is where you are. So we can control our thoughts. And I think that's the one thing that is the most powerful thing to me that really has changed everything for me, and what I want to tell other people, that you can control this. And once you learn that, everything changes after that.
Yeah. That's some good stuff. I mean, that's what I had to learn to master, to get away from those K-bar moments. I never did that. I just wanted to do it all the time.
Yeah. We all have those moments in our head. We think about it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of my journey. One of my biggest transformations personally was overcoming anger. I was angry about everything, and it was always somebody else's fault. So I'll share with you. I think I sent you a text a while back when we were talking about this, and Rhea would be a phenomenal guest for your podcast. And I'm sure she'll be happy to do it, because she, you know, it's a different thing than what you went through.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as being resilient, I mean, being a victim, not being a victim, she's definitely can talk to that in a lot of ways. But recently we've been sharing a quote I heard from Myron Golden. He's talking about victimhood. So I'm going to just add this in as a little nugget right here before we close up to go with what you said, which was great. And Myron Golden says it in a really cool way. It's one of them quotes. I never had to study it. I just heard it one time and it stuck, like most of all this stuff sticks in my brain that matters to me. And he says, victimhood's made possible when we allow contributing factors to become determining factors.
Yep.
And it, you know, we talk about, Rhea talks about, I talk about it. A lot of people who understand mindset talks about it. You know, things happen to us. Like all kinds of things have happened to you, have happened to me, have happened to Rhea, have happened to whoever you are watching or listening right now. You've had bad stuff happen to you. Sometimes it's good stuff. It's just, it's stuff. It happens to us. Those things do not determine us. They contribute to us. They can influence who we are, but we determine who we are. The choices we make, like you just said a moment ago, and I learned it from Covey a long time ago, and you may have, or maybe you didn't, but it's subconsciously, that's where I go to is, is it ain't what happens to us that's most important. It's our response to what happens to us, because our response to what happens to us determines much, but not all of what happens to us in the future. And we got to learn to let this thing right here be our friend instead of our enemy. Amen. Because whatever we're thinking about, we're always listening. There's one person we're always listening to. And I'm just sharing a little bit of this extra, Brian, because you, when you share this, it may go out to some people who maybe need to hear a little bit of the, these lessons right here at the end to go along with, you know, what you've been talking about. But, you know, we decide who we're going to be based on the thoughts that we're thinking. These thoughts, nobody determines what you're thinking but you. But the problem is, what I was about to say, there's one person on this planet we always listen to. It's the one in the mirror. We listen to this person nonstop. Unfortunately, there's something else we also do. We think what we're hearing us tell ourselves, we think it's the truth. We think that everything we tell ourselves is the truth. But any of us can validate back through our life that we've told ourselves something that obviously wasn't true. We found out later. But when we told ourselves, we thought it was true. Then we acted on that being the truth. And then we found out later it ain't the truth. So I always just caution people, be careful what you're saying, because you're always listening, but you're always listening. Think it's the truth. And you can relate to this, Brian. You know, there's a lot of people, this is in the Phoenix book and my 10 foundational elements of intentional transformation. I think this is in those first two that are chapters that are the same in each section. But what I talk about is, and you know this, you deal with a lot of people who are struggling with suicidal thoughts and that sort of stuff. But there's a lot of people out there who pull away from everyone else. And then they end up, unfortunately, a lot of them end up taking their life. And it's not because of what somebody else said to them. It's because of what they said to themselves. Nobody would ever tell them to go do that, but they telling themselves that. And then they listening to all this stuff that ain't true, but they believe is true. So everything you just said about mindset, that's why it's so important. So that piece of that you guys are doing, I mean, it's what we're doing too for a different group in a different way. But a lot of times when we're speaking, there's veterans in the audience. I mean, there's a lot of veterans all over this country.
Everywhere.
So we speak to a lot of them. So thank you for what you're doing. Anything else before we officially wrap it up?
No, that's the foundation of our program. And it's the foundation of everything else. So if someone can grab that nugget, get it from your books, that'd be phenomenal. If they're a vet and they want to contact us, or a first responder. Last year, we opened up to first responders. We realized that there's an awful lot of overlap in what they do and what we did.
Yeah.
So we changed a couple words from veteran to warrior, but our concepts and principles still fit. So if anybody wants to reach out to us and talk about this, if they want to challenge it, I'm okay with that too. I love those kind of conversations. Please reach out and talk to us.
Outstanding, Brian. And I really appreciate you being a guest here. So thank you very much for coming on. We say with Rhea and I, we don't spend time with anybody. We invest time though with a lot of people.
Yeah.
So we invested a little over an hour with you today, and thank you for sharing your story and for what you're doing for the veterans.
Thank you for having me. And looking forward to seeing what this looks like when you get it all cleaned up.
It's going to look good. So I appreciate you being here. For the listeners out there, I thank you for listening, and I hope you go check out the Blue Collar Leadership YouTube channel, and also the podcast uploads to the YouTube channel. There's a lot of playlists there for a lot of series that I've done that you can go find the audio version of a bunch of the series I've done. So, all right, we're going to wrap this one up. Thanks for being here, Brian.
See you.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks a lot.
make it happen or someone else will. It might as well be you. Are you serious about taking your career and your life to the next level and beyond? Check out Max Story's Blue Collar Leadership Series books and others, now available on audio, along with paperback and ebooks at Amazon, iTunes, and Audible. Please visit BlueCollarLeadership.com to learn about Max's books, programs, special offers, certifications, and more. Thank you for listening to the Blue Collar Leadership Podcast.